This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In his latest book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind describes the horror of watching his young son, Owen, disappear. Just shy of his third birthday, an engaged, chatty child, full of typical speech, who said things like, "I love you," "Where are my ninja turtles?" and "Let's get ice cream," fell silent.
As Suskind writes, there was a new story every day, a new horror. Owen wove about like someone walking with his eyes shut. Suskind and his wife wondered if their son had been injured somehow, banged his head, or swallowed something poisonous. It was, he says in his book, like searching for clues to a kidnapping.
The clues led to a diagnosis of regressive autism, now affecting roughly a third of children with the disorder. But Suskind's book tells the story of Owen's extraordinary 20-year journey back. He'd stopped talking, but he had retained an affinity, a passion, really, for Disney movies. And over the years, these provided him with stories, with characters, and eventually with language that allowed him to re-engage with his family and the world. Ron Suskind's new book is called Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. And he's with us now. And Ron Suskind, great pleasure to have you back.
It's great to be here, Anthony.
So, listeners, we'd love to hear, have you join this conversation. Listen to what Ron's going to say, but then think about whether you have a child or someone you know with autism. What is their passion, their affinity? What do you hear in Ron Suskind's story about his son? Is there something there that might help others with this disorder? You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Ron, if we could, let's just go back to the beginning. And I wanted to start with what happened to Owen, what you observed before his diagnosis. What changes was he exhibiting?
Before his diagnosis, he's chatting away at two and a half, usual few hundred word vocabulary of a 2.5-year-old. We moved to Washington. I was working at the Wall Street Journal, and that's when all of a sudden he starts to lose function, ability. And after 3 months in Washington, he's down to one word. Juice was his only word. And he was drinking at that point from a sippy cup. He had graduated to the big boy cup about 1.5 years before, but he was back to the baby cup. And at that point, Cornelia and I said, we need to see a specialist. And, okay. And that's when we heard autism for the first time.
That's when you heard autism. And so what did hearing that word do to you? I mean, how did you respond?
Well, it's you can almost do a before and after. You know, I can see those two people, Cornelia and me, sitting on the chair when we hear it for the first time. And then we seem to escape from our bodies and look down on those two people frozen in place. And the doctors explained to us, look, some kids never get their speech back. You have to be aware of that. This is a life journey you're now embarking on. You've got to think about supporting them for the next 50 years and for 30 years after you're dead. This is an adult moment.
Yeah. You know, you write so powerfully about what this does to a family, about what it does to your marriage, about what it does to your other son. You have a line in there that comes later in the book, but it just stayed with me. This is the crushing pain of autism, of not being able to know your own child, to share love and laughter with him, to comfort him, to answer his questions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's powerful and difficult stuff to write about and to hear about.
Well, you know, it's the book is one in which Cornelia and I, really kind of partners here in the writing of this book, had to go back over our whole life and almost relive it. At one point, we said we felt like spirits floating back over every year, looking down at those four little people. What are they feeling at this moment? What is up ahead? Now, of course, they don't know, like we don't know what's up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the book's written in present tense. So the reader feels what we feel as we feel it, both the down moments and moments of elation and some shtick. And there's comedy and there's tragedy in this book, just as we feel it, the reader does, which is why the response, I think, has been so strong.
Well, let me ask you about what happens. So he's diagnosed with regressive autism. As you say, many people with this diagnosis never get their speech back. But here's Owen, who retains this passion for Disney films, which he watched with his older brother, Walt. So tell us what happened one day in November of 1994 when you and your wife are watching The Little Mermaid with him, and he begins to say something you're not sure what.
Yeah, well, he's been murmuring a phrase, juicervos, for a few months. Now, he's not speaking at this point, and so we can't make sense of it. And then we're watching The Little Mermaid, and there's a moment moment. I think many people have seen this movie where Ariel, the protagonist, wants to become human. Ursula the Sea Witch says there will be a price. It won't cost you much. A trifle, really, just your voice. Owen's rewinding that part. Second, third rewind, Cornelia all of a sudden says it's not juice. It's just your voice. He's saying just your voice. I grab Owen. I say just your voice. He's saying juicer voice. We thought this was the moment of breakthrough. It's the first time he really looks at me in a year because, you know, the gaze aversion is part of autism. And we jump up and down in the bed. Walter's saying, Owen's talking again. We go to our doctors, though, a week or two later, and they say, let's sit down. Let's discuss this. This is called echolalia. Many folks who lose the ability to speak or auditory processing or process what they hear, they mimic sounds, just like a parrot.
So it's echo. So they're echoing what they hear.
Just like what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And that goes on for years, where we hear phrases bubbling up. You know, booty lies within was the next year. That's beauty lies within. But still, we don't know if he's understanding or what he's understanding. Now, meanwhile, Cornelia's working round the clock, you know, every day, every night. Owen is not sleeping, so she's up every night with him. Every therapist we can find. A little bit of speech is coming back, 2-3-word sentences. And then when he's about 6 and a half, you know, his brother gets a little emotional on his birthday. He's 9 years old, his older brother, Walt. And Owen walks in to the kitchen on the day of Walt's birthday and says, Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan. Now, this is his first real sentence at 6 and a half.
Walter doesn't want to grow up. So he's really he's really interpreting something here. He can't just be sort of mimicking words.
Yeah, well, that was the moment we said, oh, my God, there's a world in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, people who know these movies, it's like Aladdin in the Cave of Wonders. It's like that giant head emerges from the sand and then disappears back. So the question was, how do you get back in? And really, our challenge was to get back in that stretched across years. At that point, we start to play out scenes from movies. We realized that he had memorized them, whether he understood them or not, he had the sounds down, like putting down tracks of music.
Right.
And if you threw him a line, he'd throw you back the next line, and you threw him the next, and he'd throw back the next.
We have a clip to play, Ron. This is from a documentary that Roger Ross Williams just began filming about your family. And here you are talking to Owen about that really pivotal moment in your relationship with him when he was 6 and a half. You pick up a puppet of the character Iago, which is the parrot from Aladdin.
Yeah, the sidekick to the villain Jafar.
Sidekick, right, who's voiced by Gilbert Gottfried. But here we're going to hear you talking about that moment with your son, Owen. It's a brief clip, but let's listen.
Owen does Gilbert Gottfried better than I do, but I had to do Gilbert.
So I say, so Owen, wait a minute. How does it feel to be you?
I ain't lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah. You know, and that was the first time we had a conversation, really, you and me, since you're about 2.
Yeah.
Incredibly powerful moment there. So take us back to that day. And you know, he actually said that, I'm lonely and I don't have any friends.
Yeah.
He's channeling Disney there, but boy, he seems to be communicating something real about himself.
Well, the key was after that night, after Owen says about Mowgli or Peter Pan, I went up to his room and I put on the puppet and I talked to him as Iago, the puppet. And that is the moment where he turns to Iago like bumping into an old friend and he speaks back in a voice that I had never really heard. At that point, our house went into a kind of insanity, a lovely insanity in its way, where we said, look, we just have to play out all the parts of these movies we can find. So we start what we call the basement sessions, where Cornelia and I and Walt, his older brother, and of course Owen, start playing out scenes from movies. And Owen had memorized about 20 of the Disney movies. Again, this is the thing a lot of these kids do. It's actually called scripting by some of the therapists. They memorize the words, the scripts, and we played them out. And the key was, he not only give you back the line from Mowgli, let's say, or from Arthur, or from Simba, he would emote through the words, and that made us feel he understood what he was saying. And over years, he began to understand it. That was clear.
It's amazing. I mean, a couple of things, sort of. I've known you for a long time, Ron, and you know, I'm thinking of you in this role, dealing with an incredibly difficult challenge with a child. But you've always been an amazing mimic. I remember you doing Jimmy Stewart impersonations a year ago on this station.
I believe you did.
And so here you are channeling the skill of yours to reach your kid through Disney characters. It's mind-boggling.
Well, you know, I mean, look, the fact is he is our son, after all.
And
that's the thing. Many of the affinities, you'll find links to these affinities. And some kids are into anime, some kids are into Disney, some kids are into maps and train schedules.
Yeah.
But you'll often find a link to one of the parents that have a little bit of an affinity like that too. After all, that's whose child it is. And this was one where I could do the voices and Owen could do them better than me, because he literally had to use them and created an emotional language from the voices.
So what happened? How did this Disney material help him do that? What's the theory there?
Well, the theory is a couple of things. First off, plain and simple, Walt Disney takes these iconic tales that go back thousands of years, just like the Brothers Grimm did. These are part of folklore, the stories we told ourselves to make our way in the world.
Yeah.
And so they're iconic stories full of emotion. Now, Disney, when he begins this era of animation in the 30s, he says to the animators, I want these things to be so vivid to the eye, the expressions, the situations, that you can understand them without the sound on.
Mm.
Now, what could be better? Now, you get to the 80s, another clear twist, just an oddity, is that at that point, the VCR arrives at domestic home use. People pretty much all had VCRs by the mid-80s. The key is autistic spectrum kids could then rewind the tapes. Before that, you had to go to the movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, that was over. It was the era in which images could be part of a free feed. And this creates a change because they could rewind them over and over again and so-called hyper-systemize them. That's actually the neuroscientist term, to go deeper and deeper, to understand what was happening, to dig into new details, to meditate over the interaction of characters. And that's the way many of them, not just Owen, many of them had found a way to make sense of complex reality. It's almost like one of the neuroscientists, because many neuroscientists are now studying this called affinity therapy. That's the idea. Cornelia and I had to give it a name. That's what we called it. And they're finding that they're using their affinity almost like the Enigma machine in World War II, the code breaker, to break the code of the wider world. They turn the affinity into a toolkit, navigational equipment, and a language that ultimately ends up being a thing of high utility.
I want to just ask you this. I mean, this is an astonishing story, and we're going to talk a little bit about how Owen is doing today, and he's doing much, 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 much better than he was, though it's not all sort of, and he lived happily ever after, and we'll get to that. But what's the lesson for the broader community that is dealing with this challenge?
Well, I think it's that it's looking at a blind spot that a lot of us so-called neurotypical people do. That is just the term of art for normal. I'm not sure what that term means, frankly, anymore.
Sure.
I think we're all on various spectrums. I think we're recognizing that now. But what we did was say, be more like us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, jump around between subjects. You know, listen to what the teacher's saying.
Learn
and send it back.
Like us. Talk like
exactly.
us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to be the way. But because we felt that way, these affinities were seen as perseverative and obsessive. Cut them off. Wean the kids off them. Now the view, since the book came out, is that they're more pathway than prison. And if you go deep into them, live inside of them with the kid, you'll find that down there in that underground cavern, each of these kids seems to have one of these. There's navigation equipment. There's language that means this and that. There are ways that the kids are processing it to understand themselves. And eventually, as what happened with Owen, and we have it happening with other families that call us, we created a vehicle that he now drives out into the world. That is something that he's in charge of, because this affinity is deeply rooted in him. And, you know, look, the fact is, it's the idea is that the DNA of all things is found in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the lesson. Let them be more like themselves rather than more like us.
Boy, that sounds like real wisdom. Listeners, do you have a child or know someone with autism? What is their passion? What is their passion, if you do, their affinity? And what do you hear in Ron Suskind's story about his son? Is there something there that might help others with this disorder? You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Let me introduce Walt Suskind. And Ron, of course, this is your older son. He graduated from college in 2011. He's now a public affairs specialist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. He joins us from NPR in Washington. And Walt, good to have you and good to meet you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for doing this. I wondered if I could talk to you about the moment when you realized, and of course you were a small boy then, that there was someone there when Owen started speaking using Disney movies. I mean, what was there a sort of aha moment for you?
I don't think there was probably quite as much of a light switch moment for me as there probably was my parents. Obviously, you see in the book the Juicer Vos thing, the Juicer Vos moment and all of that. But for me, I mean, we shared a bedroom and when we were living in Georgia. We shared a bedroom pretty much until we were about 13, until I was about 13, he was about 11. Mm. So I was about as physically close to Owen over the years, I guess, as anyone. And you always, I mean, even though Owen wasn't talking, there was still, you know, action and there was still beads of interaction that I could grab that I always, you know, we always knew he was in there. It was kind of the process of drawing it out. But there were, obviously, as Disney became kind of our key into his kind of secret cupboard, that we kind of realized that there, how much there was in there, that there wasn't just this base layer that we could sometimes get flashes of, but there was this whole trove of things.
Sure. Walt, I want to ask you, you know, your dad a moment ago was just talking about this really interesting double life that was created in your household. I mean, your dad's going off and working at the Wall Street Journal as a reporter. You're going off, if I have this right, to a prep school during the day. Then you come home to your family and to Owen at the end of the day, and you're all engaged in this kind of Disney therapy to reach him. What was that like for you?
It was something that, for the most part, definitely stayed in the house. Being a fifth grader,
I'm only laughing because your dad's sitting across the table and laughing.
Don't
too,
bring this
so
out. Well, Walt, you
so
remember
it's infectious.
There was sometimes it would bleed out of the house, though. You remember that, right?
It definitely would. But I'll say, as a fifth grader, you're not getting a lot of social currency telling people you're watching the Jungle Book down in the basement with your little brother and parents. But it was. You know, that was our camp. That was our campfire that we gathered around. And like my dad had said, we were a Disney family when we were younger. When I was 2 and 3, that was the entertainment that all my other friends would have too. So it kind of was something that we had this strong basis in, and you know, we just continued to really just delve into that.
Ron, you describe Walt at one point in the book as a junior adult at age 7.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, Walt was always kind of a tough, independent kid from the very start. Talked to adults. He would make his way in any situation. And by the time Walt gets to be about 7 or 8, we're sitting him down and saying, well, obviously your brother's a little different. And, of course, Walt realizes this almost before we do, at the very instant when it's happening. And you know, and part of what was happening is well, but the book's about the stories you tell yourselves to make your way in the world. Owen found his set, and we all had our set. We would tell us the story of Walter, junior adult, can handle anything. But the key is he won't leave his little brother behind. That was a combination that Cornelia and I wanted to see. Mm. At the same time, we probably didn't recognize the struggles that Walt had trying to navigate this double life. There was a story in the book where Walt, going to the first day of first grade at a new school, 5 blocks from the school, he tells Cornelia, "Let me out here, I'm fine."
Oh, boy.
And Cornelia's like, "Walt, this isn't Dickens. They know you have parents." And he's like, "No, I'm good." Out he goes. Well, we use that as part of Walt, junior adult, you know?
Yeah.
And he rode his bike to school on his own, too. Well, Walt later explains to us, when I had to report this book with my son, which was sometimes a little uncomfortable, he says, "Look, it was just me, Owen, and Mom in the car. And if Mom brought Owen in, bringing me in, everyone would see what Owen was up to. And sixth grade boys can be a cruel bunch." That was the reality. That Walt worked his way through quite powerfully and admirably, which is a big part of what's often so evocative that readers are seeing in the book.
Walt, we've got some calls to go to, but before we do, I just want to ask you to sort of comment on what your dad said. I mean, how do you sort of articulate or recall, for instance, that episode of getting close to school and saying, "Mom, this is good enough. I'll take it from here."
Absolutely. It was pretty much like my dad described it. It was tough. I mean, when Owen was in public with us, kids would laugh, kids would point, and being, you know, 7 or 8 years old, you know, I couldn't go long form and tell him about that Owen was autistic and this and that and neurological differences, and you just kind of don't know what to do, and you want to protect your little brother at all costs. And yeah, basically my calculation was if kids wouldn't see him, then they couldn't make fun of him, and it would be, you know, it wouldn't be ideal, but it'd be better than what would come.
Let's take a couple of calls. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation with Ron Susskind and Walt Susskind. Let's go to Anthony, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Anthony, you're on the air.
All right, guys, how you doing? As I sit there and listen to you guys, I'm a single father. I had my son since he was 3 years old. He's now 11. Disney had played a major role in him being developed the way he's at right now. Like you were saying, when you go into public with my son, like when he was, like when we go to the parks, the kids would say like he's weird and he can't. I wasn't able to deal with that. But as time goes by, I mean, you guys had to support me. I had to do this on my own. His mother gave him to me since he was 3 years old and she left us. It was a battle, but I pulled through. Disney had played a major role. Even right now, as we on our way home, as I even cook him dinner, he will sit down, he'll watch Disney. He's now 11 years old. His speech is much more improved than what he was back then. My son was not even supposed to make it. He wasn't even supposed to walk. He wasn't even supposed to talk. And right now, he's talking. He's calling me daddy. We go to sporting events. Yes, he does act how he acts, but he's my son. And I will never, ever turn my back on him until I go 6 feet under. I mean,
Anthony, it's so moving to hear you talk about this. Ron is in here nodding. And Ron, I've got to believe that you're hearing a lot of stories like Anthony in response to your book.
I am. You know, it's interesting because parents are calling and say, okay, what do I do? You know, he's into this, he's into that, maybe particular movies. I said, look, think of them as toolkits. You know, what are the songs he's singing? You sing them with him. You know, and that's a kind of thing Cornelia calls it, respect the affinity. And once you do that, in a way, you're respecting them. You know, you can't have a relationship, a parent-child relationship, where you're trying to fix them all the time. That's not appropriate. But that's the way we often default into a kind of fix them, so he can make his way in the world. Instead of what Anthony clearly has done, which is to say, I'm going to sing the songs with him. If that's my son's thing, mm-hmm. I'm going to go with his bliss, and we'll have that bliss together. And you can see it sounds like how his son has emerged.
Anthony, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Terry, who's calling from Cambridge. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, hi guys. How's it going?
Very well.
Hey,
what's on your mind?
Awesome. My son is mildly autistic. He's been autistic from when he was born. And when he was very little, he didn't talk like normal kids do, which is why I'm very interested in this conversation. As he's progressed, he's basically been introduced to a lot of music and whatnot. But the funniest thing about him at this point is he has this affinity towards video games. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of funny. Like, he plays Candy Crush and those sort of little cell phone games with me all the time. And it's very much his Disney, if you want to think of it like that. Like, that's the first thing he wants to do when we see each other, and that is the gateway to opening up conversations with him. I think it's really intriguing that sort of auditory response is what moves him and what motivates him. You know, I feel like he's going to be doing a lot of things with computers in the future from just this. But yeah, he wasn't talking at all when he was younger, and now he's just like speaking volumes, but he seems to be speaking volumes through these little things that he does.
Sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I say to folks, you need to now speak video game. Mm-hmm. You know, Minecraft, of course, is a massive affinity for kids on the spectrum, you know, and many video games are ones they've embraced. And the fact is that almost any one of them can be turned into expressive language. And, you know, it's interesting when you think of the one-size-fits-all way that most of us get schooled and learn things in a kind of generalized knowledge. Here's what you need to learn and recite it and send it back to the teacher. you're saying, well, you know, that's kind of not the way the world actually works anymore when you've got all knowledge at the fingertips. You know, the Library of Congress at the touch of a finger, every video ever made in the palm of your hand. Knowledge is now freely available. The question is, what do you do with it? And many of these kids, untraditional learners, are finding ways to use these affinities for very sort of generalized knowledge and to find ways to understand themselves. And that's a great story you tell. Thank you.
Terry, thanks so much for that call. Ron, I need to ask you, and this is a sort of crucial part of the story, how is Owen doing now?
Well, Owen is at a school out in Cape Cod. It's a school for folks, some are the autism spectrum, other kids with different kinds of challenges. He'll be graduating in 2 weeks after 3 years there. And it's been a great time there for him. As soon as he got there, he started Disney Club, of course, to meet people like him, he says, and to find answers, kind of whatever that means. And first year, there's 12 kids. Now there's 35 kids in it, and they all speak Disney. As well as they do that and meditate on it like philosophers, little social connections are forming in Disney Club. Several boyfriend-girlfriend mixes, including Owen, who's had a steady girlfriend for the last 2 years. Walt is his main advisor on romance.
I want to ask Walt about that because there's a really touching story, Walt, in your father's book about the way you counsel Owen to ask his now girlfriend out on a date. And I'm just wondering, you know, what that felt like for you to offer that relatively typical big brother advice.
Sure. I mean, it was a really special moment in kind of the way the book shows that we, in one of the first times in our 22 years together at that point, were sitting down and having a conversation that brothers all over the world have, older brothers have all over the world with their younger brothers. And it was something in high school that I became kind of more aware of as I saw all these brothers of my school really going from, you know, guys who lived in the same house to best friends and sharing these things and being together. And it was something I always kind of had to wrestle with, that this would never really exist in exactly the same way for Owen myself. But being able to sit there at Friendly's with him and kind of just talk through something that, you know, every older brother wants to pass down to their younger brother is kind of a moment that obviously I'll always hold on to and treasure. And also that kind of all of a sudden we were just two guys in that booth sitting there talking. And like that paragraph finishes, didn't have to use one Disney anecdote either. Which,
you know, of course,
that's a nice story.
And the twist of it all is that, of course, kids on the spectrum are almost chromosomally incapable of lying. They always tell the truth. So Walt has to give him the rules of dating without illusion, with truth alone, which was quite a bit of a hijinks for Walt.
You know, Ron, as our time winds down, I sort of want to get a couple of sort of final ideas from you. And early in the book, you write about watching Owen in a class at a special needs school in Maryland. This is not long after his diagnosis. And this is a pretty dark scene. You're reflecting on the dreams many parents have for their young children, that their kids could be presidents, Nobel Prize winners, or just graduates of fine colleges. But as you watch Owen spinning around, murmuring to himself at that point in his life, you realize those dreams are going to, you know, you're smashing them in the corner in your mind. So this book represents such a sort of evolution for you, because what do you think now about these dreams for your son?
Our education begins at that moment. We're sitting there and a Down syndrome kid in the class comes up and hugs Cornelia and I and says, "I love you." You know, of course, we were just beginning our process of learning how subtle ability is, often emotional acuity, sensitivities. Kids like Owen, even Down syndrome kids, have very, very high quotients of these abilities. Even if they're difficult to measure, it doesn't mean they're not there.
Right.
And that's what we learn, the subtleties between ability and disability, and ultimately how we all find a way to express our essence. Owen is doing that now more and more. And so his dreams are now ones that are really his own.
Yeah.
He's carrying them forward in his very improvisational path. He wants to be an animator at Disney. This is his dream, his life dream. And actually, he's closer to that kind of thing now than he ever could have imagined, I think. Ultimately, our hope is that he has an independent and self-directed life. He will always be autistic. The challenges come every 5 seconds as he makes his way in the world. but he is living the life that he's more and more choosing for himself.
Well, Ron Suskind, what a story. He's the author of Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. Ron, thanks so much for coming in and sharing this story with us and talking about this book. We're really, really grateful.
Hey, thank you, Anthony.
And Walter Suskind is Ron's eldest son. He's a public affairs specialist at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington. Walt, thank you very much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we're talking sports with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.